Well, the Army-McCarthy hearings really blew up today in one of the most unexpected and astonishment developments that any congressional investigating committee has seen in a long, long, long time. The long and short of it is that as of tonight, Secretary of the Army Stevens takes on the appearance of a pleasant, honest, but somewhat gullible and tractable individual who has been used as a tool by Democratic Senator Stuart Symington of Missouri and one of the top characters of the White House staff of former President Harry Truman. As of tonight, Senator Joe McCarthy and his chief counsel, Roy Cohn, have demanded that Senator Symington step down and disqualify himself from further membership or participation on the investigating committee. Republican leaders in the Senate in a series of top-level huddles, which unquestionably will continue over the entire weekend. We're trying to fathom out what to do next. There won't be much sleep or play over these next 2 days, I can assure you of that. Some of them say the hearings are over, except for a few brief formalities, because the whole controversy is now exposed as something the Democrats, Mr. Symington specifically, cooked up to put the Republicans in a bad light for campaign purposes next November. Others argue that a demand should be made that Symington step down and that he be put on the witness stand under oath to be cross-examined. That was proposed earlier in the day by Senator McCarthy before all this came out, but it didn't seem to meet with too much enthusiasm at the time. In the light of the developments of the afternoon, however, there was increasing support, very considerable support of the idea in powerful Republican circles, and it may be that before the smoke clears away, Deputy Attorney General William P. Rogers, Jr. also will be drawn into the case. This whole blow-up traces back to a day weeks ago in the earliest days of these hearings when a thin, frightened-looking man who sits outside of Secretary of the Army Stevens' office in the Pentagon astounded the committee by stating that his sole job was to monitor all incoming and outgoing telephone calls of the secretary, making a stenographic record of each one except those with members of Mr. Stevens' immediate family or with the White House. On that occasion, there was a demand that all stenographic records of such telephone conversations be produced by Mr. Lucas, that was his name, all involving any of the principals in this case, and that they be brought, and that in turn brought forth a general wrangle that has lasted ever since as to whether the individuals involved would permit the records to be made public in the light of legal provisions that publication can be made only with the permission of both parties to a given call. Early this week, Acting Chairman Mudd of South Dakota, tiring of the inactivity in the production of the records of the calls, quite innocently started the ball rolling toward its climactic explosion of this afternoon by agreeing that all of his calls be read into the record forthwith, which was done. Senator Everett Dirksen, Republican of Illinois, followed the same course, and his were introduced verbatim. Republican Senator Charles Potter of Michigan announced that he would do likewise, although in actual fact they never got around to his until the close of the session this afternoon, after the fireworks. And the fourth Republican, Senator Dworshak of Idaho, had no conversations with the Secretary of the Army, not having been a member of the subcommittee at that time. At this stage of the game, Senator McClellan of Arkansas, a rather canny Democrat who is up for re-election, said he wasn't going to be left out on any limb. He had nothing to hide, and he made his public. Senator Henry M. Jackson of Washington was in the same boat with Dworshak. Nobody had honored him with a call, so he had nothing to release. And the calls that were released by Dirksen, by Mundt, and by McClellan really didn't reveal anything sensational. That left, as the sole member of the committee, Senator Symington, who all this time had been engaging in a wrangle with Senator McCarthy and Roy Cohn, as you know, demanding that they release the records of all of their calls if he was expected to do the same. Senator McCarthy agreed to do so, but charged that the Army was holding out important information in the case by refusing to release certain calls between Secretary Stevens, Army Counsel John Adams, and General Kirk B. Lawton, commanding general at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, and so the situation stood as the hearings got underway this afternoon. Committee counsel Ray Jenkins brought on the witness stand the three secretaries in the office of the Secretary of the Army, Mr. Stevens, who had monitored Mr. Stevens' calls in connection with the Cone-Shine-Fort Monmouth controversy and had them produce the transcripts that they had taken at the time of the telephone conversations, and that was it. The now famous Zwicker hearing in New York, at which time the general refused to answer questions and claims to have been subjected to abuse by Senator McCarthy. The records show that at 9 o'clock that morning, Secretary Stevens had reached Senator McCarthy by telephone at the Ten Eyck Hotel in Albany, New York, where he was going to hold hearings, and the testimony has established that at that time, Mr. Stevens told the senator that he disapproved of the way in which Zwicker had been handled and had instructed the general not to appear before the committee the following Tuesday as he had been ordered by the committee to do. This was on a Saturday. In this conversation, according to the testimony, Senator McCarthy was quite irate, blew his lid, as Mr. Stevens said, and told the secretary, in effect, that if Zwicker was not to be permitted to testify, he would subpoena the secretary himself to explain why he had so instructed, and he told the secretary to consider himself under subpoena for the following Tuesday at 10 a.m. McCarthy then hung up the receiver. The record of telephone calls shows that Stevens, apparently at the advice of his legal advisor, John Adams, then began calling members of the committee to tell them what had happened. He called Senator Mundt, who was conciliatory, and from the record of his call, clearly tried to pacify the situation, quiet Stevens down. Senator Potter reacted in much the same way, and so did Senator Dirksen and Senator McClellan, the Democrat. Then the secretary called Senator Symington, and things began to happen. Symington said that he was about to leave on an inspection trip to Europe with Senator Stiles Bridges of New Hampshire and urged Mr. Stevens not to knuckle down to Senator McCarthy, not to prejudice Symington's position by doing anything that McCarthy wanted him to do. He told Stevens that if he intended to do battle with McCarthy, if he wanted to deal with McCarthy, Stevens would have to forget the Marquis of Queensbury rules and get tough. He urged Stevens, and this was in the course of a long series of telephone calls, not just one, during the day of the 20th, most of which were made by Symington, except for the first one. He urged Mr. Stevens not to box him in. And Symington asked whether Stevens had anyone on the phone during the conversation with McCarthy, to which Stevens replied yes. Thereupon, according to the transcript of the call, Senator Symington said, "That's good. Keep the recording. Get everything down on paper." He told Stevens not to show, not to appear before the committee until Symington could get back from Europe, and told the secretary to let him talk with Clifford, and Mr. Symington would call the secretary back. Clifford turned out to be none other than the highly controversial power behind former President Harry Truman, Mr. Clark Clifford, who since his White House days has been engaged in the practice of law in Washington, and the telephone conversations indicate that not only did Senator Symington consult with Clark Clifford that day and advise Secretary Stevens a little later, but that Clifford actually was guiding and advising Secretary Stevens from that time on. In short, the situation was that Senator Symington saw the opportunity to move in on the rather naive Secretary Stevens, who was upset and who said that he couldn't afford to let the public get the impression that he was afraid of this guy, meaning McCarthy, and promptly put Secretary Stevens in the hands of one of the Truman administration's master political minds for advice and counsel while Symington, the Democrat, was in Europe. At one point in the conversations, Senator Symington said, "Now, don't put me in the box by going up there before I get back from Europe. If you and I are going to work together, we've got to be on the table with each other." This is a Democratic senator to a Republican Secretary of the Army. It might be well to remember that at this stage of the game, Stevens was being advised and guided officially by his legal advisor, John Adams, who was a holdover from the Truman administration himself. He went in under Mrs. Anna Rosenberg, and behind the scenes by Clark Clifford, who had been Mr. Truman's chief assistant and principal advisor. He held the position to Truman that Sherman Adams now holds with Mr. Eisenhower. The record shows that Symington also talked with Deputy Attorney General William P. Rogers in the course of the conversations, and he says that Rogers called him, apparently at the instance of Mr. Stevens. However, that telephone conversation is one of the ones that is not available because of the presidential directive that has been issued since forbidding it. It was the next day, February 21st, that the famous meeting was held in the office of the Attorney General, at which time Henry Cabot Lodge and two representatives of the White House were present, together with John Adams, Attorney General Brownell, and Sherman Adams, also Mr. Rogers, at which meeting Sherman Adams is supposed to have instructed John Adams to prepare a dossier on the Shine-Cohn-McCarthy matter, which started the whole present furor. There's another record of a call from Senator Symington to Secretary Stevens on March 8, just after Symington got back from the European trip, in which Stevens insisted that he had nothing against McCarthy or the committee. He thought everything had been greatly exaggerated. He knew of no collection of facts having been made by John Adams and was sure that they amounted to very little or nothing. Symington kept insisting, however, that he knew such a document was in existence, that Stevens should not allow the matter to drop. He should fight it out. More important, he should let Symington know what the facts were in the matter, that this was the advice of Clark, Clifford, and so forth. It was immediately thereafter that John Adams leaked the material to Joe Alsop and James Reston, the latter of the New York Times, both of whom were named by Senator Symington and recommended in this telephone call as being on our side against McCarthy in conversations. At the close of the day, as a final kicker, Mr. Roy Cohn announced that even if the administration does continue to hold out on the monitored telephone calls involving them, he will place in evidence the record of his own calls on Monday morning. Senator Symington told reporters after the hearing today that he has not the slightest intention of disqualifying himself as a member of the subcommittee and said, quote, "I'm not on the defensive, I'm out to find the facts," unquote. France went a long way in removing one of the roadblocks to effective aid from the United States today when Vietnam was formally given technical independence and free equal status within the so-called French Union.
10 million Americans bring you Frank Edwards and the news.
Good evening. Quonset Point, Rhode Island. A badly burned lieutenant told investigators today that he heard shouts of warning from the catapult room just a few seconds before the blast that killed 102 men on the USS Bennington. As I reported to you on the night of the tragedy, the catapults on the big carrier were filled with explosive liquid, which might have been ignited by a chance spark. The British use steam catapults to launch their planes. They have no such tragedies on their carriers. Washington Special. Last night, the Secretary of Commerce had to admit that, in his own words, we are in a recession. Tonight, the Labor Department discloses that it has just added 16 more major industrial cities or areas to its list of distressed communities, which now totals 123 major cities with surplus employment, substantial unemployment, as they say in the official statement. The Labor Department also admits that the so-called improvement in employment has not changed the unemployment picture in the nation's industrial centers. The reason the so-called improvement has not changed the picture is easy to discern. About 100,000 workers each week are dropped from the unemployment compensation rolls after having drawn all their benefits, as you knew all the time. Here are the cities and areas just added to the distressed list: Utica, Rome, Schenectady, Troy, Albany, and Buffalo, New York; Erie, Pittsburgh, and Reading, Pennsylvania; Aurora and Joliet, Illinois; Evansville, Indiana; Jackson, Mississippi; Knoxville, Tennessee; St. Louis, Missouri; and Fall River, Massachusetts, all added to the distress list because of substantial unemployment. Cities moving up toward the distress list include Chicago, Grand Rapids, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Norfolk, and Portsmouth, Virginia. The actual number of unemployed in the nation is well above 5 million. Government figures will be released Monday, giving the number of jobless as less than 4 million. Piffle for the people. New York. The man who once granted a brief stay of execution to Bruno Hauptmann was found dead today. Former Governor Harold Hoffman of New Jersey, 58, apparently died of a heart attack in his fashionable New York apartment. Hoffman gained national prominence in 1935 by granting a stay of execution to the Lindbergh kidnapper on the ground that the man might have been framed. The story behind the governor's action is this: Governor Hoffman wanted authorities to make an effort to catch the accomplices of Hoffman, a man and a woman, but no effort was made, and Hoffman died in the electric chair. Winter Haven, Florida. General James Van Fleet says he does not think that American ground troops are needed to stop the communists in Asia. He thinks the job can be done by giving the materials of war to what he calls the courageous natives of Indochina. Secretary of State Dulles joined the growing list of administration officials hinting that U.S. military action in Asia might be imminent. Mr. Dulles told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today that the communists are not seeking merely Indochina, but all of Southeast Asia. There's an interesting suggestion in my mail from some newspaper men in Texas. They say President Eisenhower's trip to Korea was designed to end a war. Why not suggest that the president now go to Indochina with the idea of keeping us out of the next war? Albany, New York. State authorities will again distribute gamma globulin, although they say there is no evidence that it helps to prevent polio. Well, at any rate, if it doesn't help the fight against polio, it does help the companies that sell the compound. What will your 1955 automobile look like? Machinist Weekly prints some preview drawings and specifications. The 1955 Chevys will have a V8 engine, or you can get a 6 in line if you prefer. And the 1955 Chevrolet will bear a strong resemblance to this year's Oldsmobile. The 55 Ford will apparently resemble this year's Studebaker front and rear, with a new front-end grille somewhat like the 54 Lincoln. Chevys, Packards, Pontiacs, and Plymouths will have V8 engines for the first time. Kaisers may also include V8s in 55. For months, I've been reporting to you that the gasoline companies were trying to keep prices high by making great claims for secret ingredients, super-duper gas at super-duper prices. Business Week magazine says that the high-pressure advertising on gasoline is an attempt to wean motorists away from regular to premium gas, even though many cars perform better and more cheaply on regular gas. Marketing expert Sidney Margolius says that the gasoline companies are trying to get themselves out of one mess by getting into another. For instance, they add tetraethyl lead to both regular and premium gas to prevent the motor from pinging. They've been doing this for years. But this lead accumulates in the cylinders, mixes with carbon, then gets hot enough to fire the gasoline prematurely, causing what is known as a wild ping. Now the gasoline companies are adding other chemicals to offset the effects of the ethyl. Does it actually make the gasoline worth more to you, or is it just another gimmick to get more money out of the nation's motorists? Mr. Margolius suggests that you make a test before you decide. Keep track of the mileage you get from a tank full of regular, then from a tank full of this super-duper stuff. After you have done that, he says, you should know whether there is enough difference in performance to justify the difference in price. Baltimore, unless the private utilities succeed in keeping it off the market, you may soon be able to buy a sheet of crystal which will provide you with all the electricity for your home directly from sunlight. Air Research and Development Command, a government unit, disclosed today that a thin slab of cadmium sulfide, 4 by 15 feet, attached to the roof of a house, permits direct conversion of sunlight into usable electricity. Cadmium sulfide is a yellow pigment used in making paint. Its operation is simple, says the Army unit. All that is required is a couple of electrodes, one silver and one indium, which are placed on opposite sides of the slab. The light strikes the big sheet of cadmium sulfide, is converted into electrical energy, and flows from the electrodes down into the house to furnish light and heat and power. Direct conversion of sunlight into cheap electricity. Capitol Hill special. Administration leaders privately admit that they have little hopes of being able to ram the president's farm policies through Congress this session. There is widespread distress among the farmers, and the president's flexible price support plan will probably be scrapped by congressional reinstatement of the Truman Farm Program for at least 1 year more. Here to give you a report on what's brewing is Congressman Wayne Aspinall of Colorado.
Thank you, Frank. What should be alarming the nation today is the sharp drop in farm income. We only have to look back 30 years ago to the 20s. To see that depressions, like cattle, are born on the farm. The farmer, along with the factory worker and the small businessman, make up the backbone of this country. When one begins to suffer economic hardship, the others are warned that they, too, are in danger. The farmer's problem today can be stated simply. He is still forced to pay high prices for everything he buys, farm machinery, feed and grain, clothes, food and household goods, and taxes. Yet he finds that when he takes his own products to market, he is paid low prices. This trend first became noticeable more than 2 years ago, and during the last year and a half, we have heard so-called experts telling the farmer not to worry, that things would level off. Well, the only thing that has leveled off, as I see it, is the little savings money the more fortunate farmer might have had. He, too, has been forced to eat into that in order to keep living. The unfortunate thing about this, Frank, is that this doesn't make headlines. The American people are being distracted today from this great and pressing problem by wild charges and countercharges on other matters that, in my opinion, are far less important. But the time is here, and here right now, when we should begin giving work, concern, and worry to the problem of what we can do to head off what may well be, if it is allowed to continue unchecked, a major farm depression.
Thank you, Congressman Wayne Aspinall of Colorado. Capitol Hill, if the Army-McCarthy farce produced anything today, it was the exposure of the utter inadequacy of Subcommittee Counsel Ray Jenkins. Mr. Jenkins, speaking over a coast-to-coast interview at the noon recess, assured the American people that he had seen the monitored telephone conversations, and they were, in his opinion, virtually worthless and insignificant as far as the hearings were concerned. Less than 2 hours later, the hearings were thrown into a prolonged uproar when it was revealed that some of the telephone conversations involved Senator Symington, a Democratic member of the subcommittee, giving advice to Secretary Stevens, a Republican, on the selection of an attorney for Mr. Stevens. It not only stirred up a first-class fracas in the hearings, but it amounted to a prompt and thorough refutation of Mr. Jenkins' ill-considered analysis of 2 hours before. The committee is still making more noise than progress. New York, officials of the AFL Longshoremen's Union say they will continue to fight to represent all East Coast and Gulf longshoremen, regardless of the outcome of the recent NLRB election on the New York docks, an election in which the old ILA was slightly ahead before they began counting the 1,700 challenged ballots. Said the trustees of the AFL Union, quote, "Whichever way the election is finally decided, even if the old ILA wins, the AFL will press on for a complete cleanup of the waterfront rackets. The AFL-ILA will hold its first constitutional convention in Chicago next month. On May 27th, I suggested that by watching the president's action when it came time to name the next federal communications commissioner, you could detect whether or not the White House was really at odds with McCarthy. Today, President Eisenhower reappointed John Dorfer to the FCC. Dorfer is McCarthy's man. Naknek, Alaska. The Defense Department is preparing to build a big Air Force project at Naknek, and they plan to build it using troop labor. Congressman Bob Bartlett protested the action today, pointing out that there is a surplus of skilled civilian labor in Alaska already. In Portage, Pennsylvania tomorrow, State Senator John Haluska will be host at a civic reception in honor of Harry Hoxie, the director of the Hoxie Cancer Clinic in Dallas, Texas. The entire community in the Pennsylvania town has been invited to turn out to honor Harry Hoxie Day. Senator Haluska became interested in the clinic when his sister was sent home from McGee Hospital in Pittsburgh as a hopeless cancer case with only a short time to live. After subsequent treatment by the Hoxie therapy, the patient is now enjoying life in normal fashion, says Senator Haluska. This should be Pittsburgh night. Two bandits played sick to pull off a $23,000 robbery from a hospital in Pittsburgh. Police say the two gunmen pretended to be patients and plastered themselves with phony bandages. Then they slugged a payroll messenger, grabbed the money, and made their escape. One of the few occasions where the patients got the money out of the hospital. Pittsburgh. Charles Irvine, veteran of World War II and the Korean War, married a girl in England in 1950. They came to this country and lived in Texas for a while he was still in service. And while they were in Texas, a son was born to them in 1951. When he went back into service, his wife and son went to England, and now they all want to come back into this country. The immigration officials say the veteran can re-enter the country and can bring in his dog, which was also born here, but not his wife and child. The veteran says he's confused. Time's up. Good night. Good news and good luck.
Thank you, Frank Edwards.